This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in our Wisconsin Life segment, we'll learn about what it's like to be an arborist. Then we'll talk about a new statewide initiative to spark conversations about the meaning of work.
First, science fiction has been big in theaters in recent years, but for the most part, the big movies have painted a really bleak picture. Think of the dark futures of The Hunger Games and Insurgent. And there's been a strong dystopian element in print, too, in young adult science fiction and beyond.
Our next guests are part of an effort to shake things up and to use science fiction as an inspiration, a way to create visions for brighter futures with an optimistic view of the potential of technology.
That effort is called Project Hieroglyph, and it's based at Arizona State University. Catherine Kramer is with us. She's a writer and editor, and she's co-editor of the new book, Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we have one of the contributors to that book with us. Gregory Benford is a Nebula Award-winning science fiction writer. He's also a professor of physics at the University of California, Irvine. He joins us from the studios of KUCI in Irvine. Gregory, thanks for joining us.
Hello there.
So, Catherine, was it a fair assessment? Science fiction has a lot of dark futures, not as much in the way of inspiration these days?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a fashion for dystopias. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of dystopias, and some of them are more productive than others. I think what Neal Stephenson was getting at when he raised the subject of dystopias is, you know, dystopianism is an attitude where nothing can be solved, and so we go about having bleak adventures. And that's fairly common in the movies, and that's certainly fashionable, particularly in young adult literature these days.
And Gregory, looking at a lot of the technological advances of the last few decades, do you think science fiction helped pave the way?
Well, surely, if you count the space program, mid-20th century science fiction was almost totally dominated by visions of how we'll carry out the exploration of the solar system. And later on, even now, we're talking about how it can work economically.
And did it work in part? I know I've heard that science fiction maybe inspired people to go into sciences and engineering and things like that. But did it also just change the way we think and change the way we imagine our future?
Exactly. Nobody's going to buy a robot, even a little Roomba that clears the house, unless they've actually heard of them before. It's part of a general rule that you cannot have a future that you don't first imagine.
And Catherine, in the introduction to the book, you mentioned things like the Great Pyramids and the Hoover Dam and things like that that wouldn't have gotten started without that imagination. Are you hoping that Project Hieroglyph will pave the way toward future wonders that we may not be able to imagine yet?
Well, I think it's worth a try. I think people may not necessarily build things that are in the book, mm-hmm. but we are trying to get people to think in a particular direction.
And Catherine,
to think about problems as things we can solve. And in Neal's point that he was making in his initial essay was that a lot of the infrastructure that we're living with now is from decades ago, and I think that one of the underlying themes of the book is creating new infrastructures.
And are we forward-thinking like we used to be? When we built those infrastructures we're walking on, driving on, using the Internet on now, were we more forward-thinking then than we are now?
I think that's true. I think that in general there was a kind of a vision of the future as something that, you know, was shiny and new and could be built. And I think we're much more cynical about it. This is not to say that great stuff has not been done. I mean, the Human Genome Project recently, you know, will make amazing changes. But there are, you know, in terms of the infrastructure of our daily lives, with a lot of it is older technology that has not changed in a long time.
And Gregory, you've written a number of novels over the years, as well as your contribution to the book Hieroglyph. When you're writing as a science fiction author, do you have these ideas in mind that in addition to telling a story and creating a world, you are trying to inspire or boost our imagination?
Yes, exactly. I like the act of imagining because the world is full of possibilities, but we largely ignore them. And that's never a good idea in the long run because, as Catherine remarked, if you build new infrastructure, there are always people who will find new uses for it.
And Catherine, for this project and this book in particular, were you aiming for things just on the horizon or way distant futures? Are we talking about galaxies far, far away or the next two or three decades?
Well, we were trying for the next two or three decades. You know, you work with a bunch of writers, you're herding cats, so not everything is in the next few decades. But it's near future rather than far future. The general intention of the book was to come up with things that scientists and engineers could get some traction on and start working on in this generation rather than, you know, saying, well, gee, 30 years from now this might be something we could work on. It was intended to be something that would inspire people to do work now.
And, Greg, you're one of those cats she was herding. Let's get into some specific technology. In your story, it centers around asteroid mining. How close is that to being a reality?
Well, there's a company already pursuing it, Interplanetary Resources. But actually, that's not the first thing that happens in the book. In the first several applications are things like really getting good robotics in space so you can build things in low Earth orbit, or just slightly beyond that, realizing that there are several hundred billion dollars worth of dead assets in geosynchronous satellite orbit. These satellites have many of them single-point failures, or their solar panels have run down. If you have robots, you can go there and do maintenance on them and bring them back to life, and that's recovering a lost asset. And that's a real business model. I thought of it, in fact, when I was writing the story.
So we're close to that step on, or are we starting to put that into practice, robots that repair those slightly failed assets for new uses?
I've talked to people who've looked at this, and they say on a scale of 10 to 20 years, yes, we could definitely do that. We need more reliable transport to geosynchronous orbit, which probably means we should start using nuclear thermal rockets out of low Earth orbit and into higher orbit because they're much more efficient.
And another point of your story, I think, is a lot of our space program so far has been to make things as foolproof as possible, not going into it with as much a spirit of risk-taking as possible. You're hoping to turn the corner on that, I think.
Right. I mean, I think it was a fundamental mistake for NASA to try to take the drama, i.e. the risk, out of space. I think knowing that things are risky makes them more interesting. You know, the Western is a whole genre that was developed not because the West was safe, but because it was so dangerous.
And, Catherine, what are some of the other technologies, including these space repair robots and asteroid mining? What are some others you might highlight in the new collection?
Well, Madeline Ashby, for example, came up with ideas for technologies about how our borders might work very differently, sort of gamifying border crossings so that highly qualified people were the ones who were allowed to immigrate, for example. Carl Schroeder has a concept for a technology that would change the way political decision-making works. And it's something that would seem to me like one of the ideas most likely to work that's in the whole book. From his point of view, we have a lot of the technologies we already need, and that a lot of our problems are political in terms of getting the power structure to apply those properly. And so his focus was on how to change that, which I think is quite fascinating.
I think I've seen you, Catherine, comment that some of the technologies in the book, reality is catching up with even as the book is being published. I think in part 3D printing on the moon was one of those.
Yeah, we had multiple writers getting in touch with us after they'd turned their stories in saying, I need to change my story because this piece of it just came true. And that is the hazard of writing near future science fiction, in that you know, you think you're ahead of the game, but you know, you may not be.
Gregory, how often has this happened to you? You've written novels set in the recent near term, I think, where, you know, the U.S.-Soviet Union rivalry, for example, plays a major role in it. Does it disappoint you when history catches up and takes things in a different direction?
Well, remember, Russia currently is just mostly run the same way the USSR was. They've just changed the label. But my history of bumping up against the future, it goes all the way back to the late 60s when I published a story describing the first computer virus. In fact, I wrote the first computer virus on the DARPA net in 1969. But the point is, I described this And no one really thought it would ever be a threat because they couldn't see any motive to do it.
Whoops. So yep. We're ahead of the curve there. Catherine, how much of the role of science fiction is predicting the future, and how much of it is, I guess, making us interrogate the future and think about it and how it affects our lives in the present?
Well, I mean, well, there's a lot of things that one can predict or point to that science fiction predicted. If you go item by item through the things that were projected by science fiction, we don't have a very good track record. There's lots and many, many more things that did not come true. If you think of it in terms of, you know, inspiration and getting people, you know, getting people to think about the future in a problem-solving way and in an extrapolative way, science fiction's had a huge impact. And that's what we're trying to highlight with this book. This is about getting people moving, not, you know, telling you what the future is.
And Gregory, I think a lot of people might think science fiction and get the trappings of the spaceships and the high technology. How much of it is predicting the future of humanity, how we act, our laws, how we behave?
Well, that's always the goal. Is you introduce a new technology and you see how it changes the human prospect. We science fiction writers are mostly concerned about expanding human horizons. And over the horizon lies new kinds of ways of behaving. We're extremely different from the people of only 200 years ago, for example, in many of our attitudes, but also our capabilities. I have a left shoulder that I broke surfing, which is repaired and functional, and that would never have happened. And without it, I would have been an invalid most of my life.
We're talking to author Gregory Bedford and editor Catherine Kramer. They're both involved with Project Hieroglyph and the new book, Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future.
And you can join the conversation. Do you think science fiction can be an inspiration for technology and other innovations? Is there a science fiction book, movie, or TV show that you think provides an inspiring vision for the future? And do you feel like there's been a glut of bad news in science fiction and movies and elsewhere? Lots of dystopias with little positive side. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with science fiction author Gregory Bedford and editor Catherine Kramer. They're part of Project Hieroglyph, an effort to create positive visions of our technological future. The new book is from the book Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future.
And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Is there a science fiction book, movie, or TV show that inspires you, that inspires a vision of future and the way we interact with technology? Is there a technology that you think is on the horizon that's going to change the way we live on this planet or beyond? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Mike on the line now in Franklin. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. No, I just wanted to say that I actually respect both your authors greatly. I enjoy their work. I disagree with the premise that that we need to have more optimistic versions of the future represented in literature. In my mind, I've been reading science fiction since I was probably 10 or 11 years old. I'm 47 and probably read, I don't know, maybe 1,000 or so works. And it seems like the body of science fiction that I've read is fairly evenly distributed between dystopian and utopian, and it's sort of independent of when it was written. It seems like there's plenty of examples of authors that have fantastic visions of the future that are currently writing, and I would say that was true of the past as well, and there's dystopian versions of the future that were written 35, 40 years ago or longer, and that there were utopian versions written then as well.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Gregory Benford, I'm guessing you wouldn't argue with a lot of what he had to say, but do you think there's enough of what you're doing in Project Hieroglyph, of the near-term technological optimism in the science fiction world?
Yes, there's a great deal. And I agree with the caller. I mean, look, utopian positive science fiction tells you things you maybe should do. Dystopian tells you maybe things you shouldn't do, and therefore they're sides of the same coin. But the main point is to get people to think about the future and realize it can be different.
And Catherine, you've worked not just in this project, but lots of other volumes you've edited with a lot of authors. Do you think there are, can you give us a couple names of authors operating in this near-term vision that you're looking for here that you could point us toward for further reading?
Well, I mean, Kim Stanley Robinson is somebody who came into the science fiction field doing pretty much this sort of thing and has been doing it ever since. A lot of the hard science fiction writers tend to have a kind of positive, optimistic vision. What I think Neal Stephenson felt was lacking was particularly the sort of thing aimed at infrastructure. And I think that the generalized attack on dystopianism as such is a bit too vague, and that there's a lot of different ways things can be, you know, upbeat versus downbeat, having happy endings, having likable characters, et cetera. And I think he really meant something very specific having to do with whether it inspired us to innovate in infrastructure.
Mike, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Mike in Eau Claire. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was going to talk about Dune. It's far into the future, and humanity colonized the entire universe, you know, thanks to that wonder drug, the spice, that gives people the ability to build a, you know, fold space and everything. And as a result, then you have all these separate planets with separate governments, and they basically just ditch democracy, and it's run by a, you know, like a feudal society, you know.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. So Dune, as he said, Gregory, it's pointing to the distant future, but some fears that I know some people feel in the near term, too.
Well, indeed, let's point out that some of the major societies on the planet, like China, are basically not democracies. They are authoritarian in an extreme way. So that's a kind of bleak vision of the future, I think. But it's common. Yes.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Catherine, wanted to talk about Project Hieroglyph beyond the book. I know that it works not just with science fiction authors, but with researchers and professors in various fields of science and technology. How do you bring together, how are the authors and these researchers brought together to try to make the ideas a little closer to reality?
Well, first, you should understand that this project is sort of a special project that was put in motion by the president of Arizona State University. So we have a completely unprecedented situation where not only is it possible for scientists to participate in this in a science fiction project, but they're getting active support and encouragement from the top of the top of the university administration. Now, the person who put them in contact, our writers in contact with the scientists and engineers, is my collaborator, Ed Finn. I mean, he has the Center for Science and the Imagination at Arizona State University, and they had sort of would find out what the needs were from the authors and do a certain amount of matchmaking between authors and scientists. But we'd really like to do this sort of thing on a much larger scale, involving more disciplines, more visual things, and also works that reach a much broader audience.
Gregory, it seems like a challenge in this near-term science fiction we're talking about is the sense of maintaining a sense of wonder. And what I mean by that is, if you explained the internet to somebody 30, 40 years ago, they would have thought, wow, what a science fiction concept, or how implausible that is. And now we order our groceries on it and, you know, send notes to grandma on it. We take it for granted now. How do we take this gosh wow stuff that's in the near term and keep being excited about it as it starts to become a reality?
Well, it's worth remarking that, yeah, a lot of people like me 40 years ago could see the internet coming, but what we didn't see coming was Facebook. So it's the social evolution that really gives you the biggest surprises, because people are so endlessly innovative and very social. So I think, yes, that's the tough part of science fiction, is looking at the second order effect. I mean, lots of writers like H.G. Wells foresaw the influence of the automobile. What they couldn't predict was the drive-in movie theater or backseat sex.
And Catherine, in the Hieroglyph book, do the authors take the infrastructural ideas that they look at and try to figure out then how humans are going to interact with them? I know Gregory did with the technology that he talks about. What are some of the other examples of how society reacts to these near-term technological changes?
Well, Brenda Cooper's story takes the idea, you know, the current day technology of drones and extrapolates it as something that could be used to prevent poachers from driving animals extinct in Africa. Whereas Lee Constantinou has a completely different use of drones in his story. It's a sort of counterculture effort to keep the internet safe from governmental domination, where all the little wireless routers are in these cute little drones flying all over the place. So, we take one basic technology, which is essentially a military technology right now, and we see several very different social extrapolations from it.
Catherine, what's the next step after a Hieroglyph? What do you want to take Project Hieroglyph to as your part of it from science fiction authors and others?
Well, I mean, we're going in a couple of different directions. There's a project that I'm also involved with, which is called Evoke, which is a combination online graphic novel and game thing in collaboration with the World Bank. And, of course, we'd also like to do more volumes of Hieroglyph, but we'd also like to expand into other media like film and television. So we want to go further with this. We feel this is just the beginning rather than the end of the project.
And Gregory, as we wrap up, what would you like to see from the science fiction writers of the future?
I'd like to see more innovative ideas, and particularly look at even the ideas that are in this first volume of Hieroglyph and take them further and see what they'll do. Here's an example. I realized after looking at Neal Stephenson's 20-kilometer-tall tower idea that the potential difference between the head and the foot is over 2.5 megawatts. And if you do the calculation, you find out you can power the entire American Southwest with free energy gotten this way, a completely new way to get energy out of the world.
Gregory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Catherine, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We've been hearing from Gregory Benford, Nebula Award-winning science fiction author, and Catherine Kramer, writer and editor for Project Hieroglyph. They've been talking about the new book, Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future.